Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 18, Episode 17. Coming up on this show, we've got Bigfoot gas guns, alien abduction gel pits, and Tenzin Osel, the Spanish llama baby. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
I have a bit of a theme coming up for this episode. After the last Plus show, when we mentioned the story of the woman who drove into that massive pink bubble.
It was the all jelly ball.
The jelly ball thing and how she had all the paint flying around and she was ecstatic about it. I figured it'd be a really good idea to come up with what I like to call the states of paranormal matter. So I know that sounds a little bit pretentious and I kind of went with gases and then liquids and then I spilt my coffee over my notes so I stopped with solids.
What about plasmas?
Well, we've got
plasmas?
We've got gels and there are a couple of stories of UFOs dropping plasmas. So it's a little, we're kind of there. We're just not all the way there.
Wow. Sounds pretty dry. Why don't you do the geology special of the paranormal up next?
And for 15 minutes, you'll listen to paint drying. I have that coming as well.
Awesome.
No, come on. It's really good stories. The last thing I'd actually expect there to be paranormal phenomena related to gases and clouds and mists and liquids. And yet there's a huge amount of it. And it all seemed just to come together this week really nicely.
Well, that story from the last Plus episode was really cool. The woman and the three kids in the back of the car driving across a deserted highway in the middle of Australia.
Isolated.
And coming across, what was it? Just a giant
in the
pink
distance.
Bubble on the road.
Yeah. Well, in the distance, it was hovering and it was massive. And it came down onto the road and kind of spread itself across the road. And like all good Australian drivers, you don't stop. You just keep going. So she drove straight into this thing and pulled over because it was this pink, cloudy kind of mist that you could mess with and play with, and it filled them all with this ecstatic. It was like being on ecstasy.
Yeah, they were high.
Yeah, they were absolutely high. But once they left the bubble, all of that feeling dissipated and all disappeared. So there was something about some weird bubble that's floating around that's giving people a high that just flies off into the sky.
This is new.
Stuff.
This is new. I'm intrigued. We've been locked away separately for most of the week, working on our own stuff. I was trying to find something new to go into, so went to the library across the road, the Theosophical Library.
Oh, yeah, and how was that with all the construction noise?
Well, after Graham explained to me the history of light bulbs for 2 hours, I finally found... No, seriously.
Is that why you took so
just,
long?
He starts talking, he just comes over. You get about 5 minutes on your own before Graham comes and starts telling you a story.
I love him. I think he's a really lovely guy, but it's almost like I'll be standing there at one section and I can kind of, you know you're being watched and I feel like there's something over my shoulder and I turn around and he's just standing there.
For our new listeners, Graham's the old librarian that is often taking care of the Theosophical Library across the road from us. And he's always got great stories to tell, but...
like the transvestite story, but that was just great.
Well, yesterday he kind of lurked a bit, then he came over and he just started telling me the history of LED lighting in Australia. And at the end of this massive story, I was like, Graham, why are you telling me this? And he just said, oh, I just like to ramble.
Well, at least he's honest.
And I was like, okay. And in that moment, as I turned the corner, I found a couple of reincarnation books that I hadn't seen in the library before. I don't know if they'd been borrowed while I was looking, but there was one from Vicky McKenzie, actually two from Vicky McKenzie. One was called Reincarnation, The Boy Llama.
Mm-hmm.
And on the cover is a Caucasian kid, about 2 years old, wearing a full Tibetan Buddhist's outfit. Like all the robes, the yellow shirt, the red robes. And I thought, what is the story behind this? So I started to look inside at some of the pictures. And there's a strange case here of a llama who died in 1984. And said he was going to come back very soon in the West.
Oh, hence the Caucasian kid.
11 months later, this kid is born that has the same weird personality and attributes of this Tibetan llama, except he's a Spanish kid. And the story of the family and how they eventually discover this reincarnation connection is really fascinating. I'll be talking about that in the Plus extension.
So what's the other one that you've got there?
Oh, Reborn in the West. I picked this up as well. I'll probably do this on Tuesday's show, but this is a follow-up from Vicky McKenzie, and she's got a story in one of the later chapters of a Hasidic rabbi in Minneapolis. And apparently he claims he's had hundreds of people approach him who claim to have past life memories of dying in the Holocaust, of Jews being Jews dying in the Holocaust.
Oh, how awful.
But in this life, they're not Jewish, they're Gentiles.
Oh.
They have these memories. So he's been investigating this and trying to see if they can verify some of these so-called past life memories.
Oh, great. That'll be really interesting. Oh, well, we'll do that on Tuesday. Well, let's jump into the states of matter, and we'll start off with gas. And as I said, it was really serendipitous about how this all came together, because I happened to pick up a copy of the latest edition of 14 Times last week.
Which had an article about Bigfoot gas guns.
Well, no, that kind of ties in with something else that Nick Redfern wrote. But yes, it had an article in there by Theo Pymans, actually, about vampiric vapors and attacking mists. And as luck would have it, as I was preparing this segment and thinking about what I was going to do, Nick Redfern actually published an article on mysteriousuniverse.org on our site, talking about a woman who's had a very strange experience only at the start of this month. October the 4th, this woman had this experience. And she claims that she was attacked by an entity that utilized some type of mist or fog-like substance. Now, the witness is called Emma, and she claims that on October the 4th, in the early hours of the morning, she was awoken suddenly and became gripped with absolute fear and terror. And it's kind of along the lines of sleep paralysis. It all kind of fits in with sleep paralysis.
Yeah.
Because when she awoke, she realized that she couldn't move, and that's where the feeling of terror came from. But she could move her eyes. And when she looked down towards the end of the bed, she could see standing in the hallway, in the open doorway, was this tall figure. It was a man, but she couldn't quite make out who he was. But he was standing there dressed in a black suit, and he was staring at her with these fiery red eyes. So very classic shadow person experience, but the fact that it's wearing a suit is very, very strange. And Nick is kind of leaning towards the link between the shadow person experience and the Men in Black experience. He thinks that there might be something going on there. But in this particular case, as the woman made eye contact with this terrifying figure, she said the room was suddenly filled with this thick, choking gas that smelt of rotting eggs and sulfur.
Oh, sulfur again.
The sulfur was released, or this gas was released by this entity all through the room. And as it was, she said this was enough to cause her to choke, but the actual feeling of choking caused her to snap out of her state of paralysis. So she jumped up from the bed and goes running towards the door. And as she does, she said this thing, this entity, just dematerialized before her eyes in the very doorway. Now, despite being in this cold sweat and a panic, and she's traumatized by this experience, she actually decided against calling the police, and primarily because, as Emma said to Nick, I don't believe that this was human. I mean, obviously,
what are you going to say?
It dematerialized. I mean, exactly. You're not going to call the police and say, something just gassed me in my room and I was paralyzed and then it dematerialized before me. But the thing is that on its own, it's still a very, very strange case. But Nick says, look, I get plenty of these cases all the time. And in fact, if you look back at the literature, even Albert Bender, the guy that kicked off the Men in Black lore back in the 1950s, claimed to experience powerful sulfurous odors whenever those Men in Black, those gaunt creatures, yeah, would show up in his home.
And again, the sulfur-like smell is heavily researched by Joshua Cutchin.
That's
in
right.
The Brimstone Deceit, that fantastic book from last year.
Yeah.
Covering all those cases, all that phenomena where that particular smell just appears again and again and again.
Yeah, it's so strange. And I wonder what it is about that particular smell, but the fact that it's still occurring. Sometimes I get this feeling that when we cover stories on the show, we find these great stories, but it seems like the phenomena at times dies down. But I think it's like what Jacques Vallée pointed out, is that there's like this psychological effect about when you want to make a change or cause an impact upon a population, let's say a group of students, the best way to do that is to be infrequent and then provide sort of, you know, peaks and troughs. And that seems like what the phenomenon is doing. It sort of spikes up and you have a massive flap and then it dies down again. And then just this keeps on going on and on and on. And it seems like at the moment things are kind of starting back up again. But the reason why this particular case really stood out for Nick, and obviously for us as well, is that Emma lives in the Illinois city of Mattoon, the very city that was terrified by the Phantom Gasser, or the Mad Gasser,
yeah,
back in the 1940s. Now, if you don't know what the Mad Gasser is, I'll just give you a little brief rundown about the history there. But between August the 31st and September the 13th of that year, a thin, black-clad assailant would spread a reign of terror with a series of unprovoked and invasive gas attacks. And when I mean gas, what people saw and what people experienced is this sweet-smelling odor that would come through their windows or under their doors, and then all of a sudden they would be paralyzed or immobilized or become violently ill, and there would always be some type of figure that would appear that would be tall wearing black and being very thin and very gaunt, much like what you hear from the modern Men in Black reports. But what was kind of strange with the Mad Gasser of Mattoon is that there were reports of once this figure fled into the distance, they found footprints, but the footprints were women's shoes.
What the hell?
It's really, really strange.
Yeah, I want to go back to those reports, actually, because often the Mad Gasser of Mattoon is depicted with tanks and a sort of instrument to pump the gas.
Yes.
But I'm not sure if all the sightings had that.
No.
It just seemed there was gas associated with this entity like this modern account that you just described.
Well, I'll get to actually a point where the Mad Gasser phenomenon, even though it really took off in Mattoon in the 1940s, it's something that has appeared over many years. I mean, even decades before, you had these flaps of gases appearing and causing people to be paralyzed by the release of some type of noxious substance. But with the Mad Gasser of Mattoon, it's really sad, actually, because when encounters like this kind of start disappearing from living memory, of course they're written down, but all the people that experienced it are starting to pass on. When things are put out there by skeptics that, oh, well, it was all complete mass hysteria, it starts losing some of its importance, yeah. I think. You know, and people start going now, oh, well, that was all completely mass hysteria. No, the police at the time, the local authorities, despite investigating some very credible cases, started publicly saying, no, that this is just a complete mistake and people are just suffering from hysteria, to quell public panic. So maybe some cases may be hysteria, but there were a number of cases which paranormal investigators have looked into which do have credible evidence.
What was the motivation for the Mad Gasser? Was he trying to find a dress to match his shoes? What was he taking? What was he doing?
He never took anything, but
right. He
did manage to, he always struck in the evening for the most part. I shouldn't say always, but for the most part, this is the theme. He struck in the evening. He struck when it was a woman by herself. So you're right. Maybe he was just trying to swipe her clothes. Maybe he was too embarrassed to go to a department store. But it was always this kind of reoccurring theme. And it was a very, for the most part, gaunt man wearing black. But let me describe one of the very earliest cases that really kicked off the phenomenon. And it started with the night of September the 1st. And this was a Mattoon
resident. What year again?
This is 1944.
Right.
And there was a resident by the name of Dorothy Kearney. And she'd just climbed into bed after putting her kids to sleep when she noticed this odd sweet odour in the air. Now, at first she thought it was coming from the flower bed outside her bedroom window. But as the smell got stronger and stronger, she actually realised that she was losing feeling in her lower body. Now, she started to panic and she tried to get out of bed, but she couldn't get out. So she started screaming out for her sister, Martha, who was actually staying in the house as well. Now, Martha rushed into the room, and it's a shame that there's not much more information on this, because I would have been interested to know if when Martha rushed into the room and she smelt it, she said she could smell it. She could smell the smell coming through. It doesn't describe whether or not she was paralyzed as well. Because if it was some type of paralyzing gas, you would expect anyone exposed to it would have a similar response. Regardless, immediately they called the police. After a couple of hours, she managed to retain her ability to move and everything was okay. The police attended, but they couldn't find anything. There was no sign of a prowler, nothing. But the incident didn't end there. Later that night, after the police had left, Mrs. Kearney's husband, Bert, who was actually returning from his job as a taxi driver, was walking up the driveway when he noticed a tall man dressed in black clothing peering in through the bedroom window. Now, Mr. Kearney gave chase, but the stranger seemingly just disappeared. The police returned, but as before, found nothing. Now, I want you to pay attention because it could be a coincidence that perhaps, well, she's had this gas attack and then there just happens to be a figure there that night, some type of burglar perhaps later on. But the fact that he seemingly disappeared is starting to line up with what happened to Emma and her experience with this man dematerializing.
And it seems as though in a lot of the reports, no one was really affected. I mean, there was some reports that they were getting sick for a couple of weeks afterwards.
Yeah.
But no one was really physically attacked, were they?
Nothing was stolen,
as you said. No one was kidnapped. No one went missing.
No one was physically injured.
So if this, whatever this guy was, if he was trying to maybe take someone away, he wasn't very good at it.
I mean,
that's what you would think, right? He's trying to, the logical idea is he's trying to knock someone out and kidnap them.
Absolutely.
Or knock them out and rob the house.
Yeah, which has happened. I mean, even only recently, there was this report, I think it was a football star or a baseball star, I can't recall exactly, but someone actually did release anesthetizing gas in his home and robbed his home.
I think it was the Formula One driver.
Oh, was it a Formula One driver, was it? It's a very clever idea, actually, because you incapacitate people. There's going to be no threats to your well-being, and you get in and steal what you want, and then you get out. So I see how it works, but...
Yeah, Jensen Button.
Right, yeah.
Robbed by French burglars using gas.
Look, it's very dangerous because obviously, I mean, there's a reason why anaesthetists are paid as much money as they are, because if you over-anaesthetize someone, you potentially could kill them. So they ran the risk of attempted murder and murder charges and whatever else. But I digress. In these particular cases, there seems to be a paranormal element to it. And funnily enough, it lines up much more with the shadow person phenomenon in the fact that they're not stealing anything, right? So, like, what's their motivation? As you said, no one's being injured, but it's creating fear. It's creating panic. It's like, is this what they feed on? If this is a new way of generating a fear. I mean, yeah, you wake up in the middle of the night with a figure standing in your room and you're paralyzed. Of course you're going to be terrified. Maybe that doesn't work with everyone. Maybe you have to use some type of gas or some type of effect to get the same, you know, response from people. But of course, at the time, as this was really taking off, I mean, there was one night in Mattoon back in September, I think it was September the 4th or 5th, where there were six attacks in one night. And people all saw this black-clad figure getting around and they all smelt this same smell. And people were going wild. I mean, I understand to a point why the authorities were playing it down. Because people were claiming that it was Nazi spies, it was government testing, you know, it was the Second World War. You could see why there was a lot of panic going on. But the events seemed to really accumulate to this spectacular supernatural crescendo with the events that surrounded Edna James. So one of the last reported, it wasn't the very last, but one of the last reported and major incidents of the mad gasser of Mattoon came about at the end of September when Edna James said she was lying in her bed one evening when she noticed this strange odour wafting into her bedroom. She said it didn't immobilise her, but she actually got up and started following the scent as it got stronger. She said the scent was coming from her kitchen, which she followed in. Now, when she got into her kitchen to investigate, she claims she came face to face with the mad gasser, but it wasn't a human being, but rather a strange ape-type man with long arms and a deformed face. It pointed its spray gun at her and doused her in a cloud of gas before dematerializing before her eyes.
What is Bigfoot Waboo doing there? Has he just gone astray?
This bitch.
He's gone. Why has he gone off the rails? Why is he gassing women in the night?
So, yeah, I mean, this woman got gassed. The terrified woman was left temporarily paralyzed, lying on the floor. And this ape man Bigfoot gasser just dematerialized and disappeared. And, of course, this is when much of the activity finally died down. So it's kind of strange. I mean, if you look at it from, you know, an umbrella perspective, it started off strange as it was, but then it seemed to really accumulate. Like, it really hit this level of high strangeness with an ape-type creature finally appearing. Now, the problem was, because this woman's job, her job was she was a card reader or a fortune teller, people immediately completely dismissed her and said, oh, you're just a crazy. But people who knew her said, no, she's actually a very reliable, down-to-earth person. Just because she read tarot cards doesn't make her crazy.
And there's been speculation that it was some kind of real pollutant from a nearby factory or nearby industrial plant.
Yeah.
And it kind of makes sense on the surface because, I mean, maybe this could induce hallucinations and people think they're seeing figures in the dark.
It's certainly a possibility.
From what I was looking into, it didn't seem like there were plants in the area that had chemicals that would create this effect, or if they did, they weren't in the quantities that would be required to make so many people hallucinate something.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, other people were also claiming that it was a deranged science student who had gotten his chemistry set and was running around town. But I don't see it. I mean, why would you go to that level of gassing people just for fun? And of course, when you add this supernatural element to it, it just makes it that much more stranger and unexplainable. And Nick actually says, you know, is there a connection between the Men in Black phenomena, the shadow person experience, and mad gasser attacks? And is this the start of the mad gasser returning to Mattoon? Or is it just a one-off incident? But Nick doesn't know the answers, but he says, you know, we really should watch this space.
Because the classics are coming back.
They're coming back.
Mothman's back in Chicago.
It's like
the Mad Gasser's back.
Yeah, it's like fashion. It just goes in cycles.
Wait, this is all in Illinois, right?
This is Illinois.
What the hell's going on in Illinois?
Yeah, there's something.
What are you guys doing over there?
There's something very strange going on over there. But of course, as I said earlier, I mean, Mattoon isn't the only flap where there was a supernatural element involved. In fact, a decade before the event, in 1934, on February the 9th in Oregon, a J.G. Schaefer claimed that a gasser had infiltrated his home and managed to escape by running through a snowdrift into his barn. Now, this was a typical type of case like what we just reported with the Mattoon cases. The difference in this one, though, is that Schaefer actually managed to collect a sample of snow from outside his bedroom window where the gasser had been spraying in some type of substance, and he had it chemically analysed. It was this sweet-smelling material, and strangely enough, the analysis revealed that it contained arsenic and sulphur. So poisonous, and that sulphur smell. So obviously, you know, we get where the sulphur is coming from, but why arsenic? It's just very, very odd. But where the paranormal element comes in here, apart from the fact you've got some weirdo spraying poison in through your window, is that when this thing ran out through the snowdrift into his bar only had one entry, and he sat watching, waiting for the police to arrive. Now, when the police arrived, they stormed the barn and found it empty. Even more disturbingly, while they found the tracks that entered into the barn, there were no tracks coming out of it. And there was no way that that entity or whatever it was could have left that barn without being seen or could have hidden that barn without being found. Yet again, you have 10 years before the Mattoon attacks, you have some type of dematerialization going on. And funnily enough, much like the Mattoon case, this was investigated by the police, and the police actually issued statements as well saying that the mad gasser was nothing more than a flight of fancy spread by out-of-control rumours and a few defective chimneys.
What defective chimneys?
Yeah, so apparently defective chimneys were causing a build-up of gases inside people's homes, which was leading to hallucinations. But the problem is that this is actually, call it what you want, but this is a deliberate act of disinformation. When there really was something strange that was going on, and the police and local authorities were acting in the interests of the public, which is all well and good, but it actually then muddies the waters when you try to do investigations as to what was really going on here. Yeah. But look, we've looked at the assailants, but what about the gas itself? And if you take a deep look into paranormal literature, you actually find that there is only rare but compelling cases of strange mists, clouds, and fogs that interact with and sometimes attack witnesses. And so this brings me to Theo Pyman's article, which was published in the latest edition of the 14 Times magazine. It's issue number 358, and of course I'll link to it in the show notes so you can check it out for yourself. I mean, it really is a great publication. But Theo went to a lot of effort to find these very odd cases of clouds attacking and sapping the life from their victims. And it all starts back in Iceland on the 29th of March in 1892. There was a small village where 10 fishermen were staying in a hut, and because it had been raining and bad weather and whatever else, they all decided that they weren't going to go out. They were just going to spend the remainder of the evening inside this hut. Eight of them had fallen asleep and two of them were still awake. Now, two of them, as they were lying there awake and they were just listening to the rain and to the wind going away, they claimed that they heard a very strange noise come from one of their sleeping companions. The sleeping companion started making the kind of noise. It wasn't...
Bad
like,
dream?
No, it wasn't a bad dream. It was even more, it was like a distress sound. It was a very distressing sound, like someone was trying to call out, but was unable to wake up. So the primary witness in this case was Eyjolf Olofsson. And Olofsson said that he looked over at his friend who was still awake and actually thought that the behavior was so odd that it warranted the man actually waking him up. So they went over and shook him awake. And when he woke up, he said, "Oh, I just had the most unpleasant draining sensation, this exhaustion." And just as that happened, another sleeping fisherman began behaving in exactly the same way. Still asleep, but not asleep. Still being tormented by something that no one in the hut could see. As this happened, and they're looking around the room, one of the men who was awake all of a sudden fell down. They said his colour in his face actually changed. His pallor went this white, and he fell unconscious. Now, as he fell unconscious, they went over and shook him up and woke him up as well, and he too claimed that all of a sudden he'd been struck by some type of unknown force that had drained all of his energy, and he was fighting as hard as he could against it, but somehow it was able to overcome him. So this thing went on through the night. Each of these men, this force, seemed to jump from bunk to bunk to bunk, draining the energies and attacking these 10 fishermen that were inside this hut. And what these guys did is that because Iceland is known for having an understanding of folkloric traditions and those sorts of concepts, they actually thought that there was something there, but they were all unwilling to talk to each other and reveal what they were seeing.
Come on, guys.
Yeah, it's like, "Oh, I'm not seeing that. I'm not seeing that." And in this, they all went out and got a church bell. They got a local church bell and they brought it in and they started banging the bell and thought that that would be enough to somehow cast out this entity or whatever it was. So they did so. And for one night, they had a decent night's sleep. The following night, the entity was back and it became so bad that they all decided to get the hell out of there. And they fled. They fled that third night. But when they fled and a few days had kind of passed, it turns out that for a period of 6 weeks, it wasn't just these guys, because there were a group of huts that were in the area. All of those huts were harassed by some type of force that did exactly the same thing. And after these reports started coming back to these fishermen, they finally felt safe enough to describe what they had seen, what had been stalking these cabins. And they said, it looked like a bluish cloud of vapor that moved back and forth, sometimes glowing, but moved as if it was under intelligent control. Some of the other fishermen said that they had seen a misty lump about the size of a small dog. It would drift near the window, almost as if it was looking in. They said that the lump had some sort of tentacle appendage attached to it, which would be used to probe the glass of the pane of the window and then use it to maneuver itself inside. Once inside, this cloud entity would start sapping the energy from each of these men.
That's a weird detail, that it's got an appendage and it has to open the door.
Yeah,
you would presume it would just float through the physical matter.
Yeah.
No, it's actually going to open the door
using it.
Like a velociraptor. How did you describe it?
It's a tentacle appendage.
Yes.
A tentacle appendage of this bluish kind of cloudish mist. Now, as I said before, because the country is familiar with the folklore and superstition, they got a local soothsayer in to actually bless, not even bless, but apparently he knew powerful words to keep this thing away. And he went into this hut and he spoke these enchanted words or whatever he had to do. And he said, don't worry, the thing's gone for 9 years, but I only had enough energy to get rid of it for 9 years. So after 9 years, well, you're on your own. And we don't know what happened after that. I mean, Theo says that there's no other reports that refer to 1901 and if anything happened. But the mention of the tentacles actually piqued Theo's attention. And he thought, are there other cases of some type of tentacles or anything else appearing? And indeed there are. He says there's plenty of reports of people encountering vaporous manifestations that either have tentacles, prongs, or protrusions, and they don't seem to harbour the best of intentions. Take, for example, Cheshire farmer Herbert Balfour, who in 1953 lost 53 pigs in less than 2 weeks. Now, vets examined the carcasses, but were unable to determine a reason for the sudden mass death. No poisonings, there was no change in their diet, there was no virus or no bacteria from what they could tell. It was completely unexplained, as if something had sapped their life force from them.
Wait, are they exsanguinated or do they have blood?
It doesn't say anything about blood, but it just describes that they had just passed away in this strange mass death.
Okay, so it could have been a disease or something.
Potentially, but the vets examining it would have reported that, but they couldn't determine that. There's nothing that could be determined. But you're right, we can't completely rule out viruses. But when you combine it with the following effects, then you start going, maybe there's something to this. Because the farmer says that 2 days after he lost his last pig, he claims that he encountered a large black cloud about 7 feet in height stalking around his farm. He said it was a shapeless form except for two distinct prong-like appendages that were sticking out from it. A few days later, his wife, who unbeknownst to her, he had seen this but he didn't report it to her, claimed to see exactly the same thing, this creature stalking around the home. Soon after, he found the cloud in his kitchen. Much like the Bigfoot story before, he came into his kitchen to find this tall, floating black mass.
Wait, it's tall? Why is it tall?
It's like 7 foot tall. It's this 7 foot tall, thin, but black, twirling, turbulent mass of smoke.
It's the smoke monster from Lost.
No, but I do have a smoke monster story coming up. But these two prongs are sticking out of it, right? So he wanted to get a better look because he wanted to understand what the hell this thing was. Because I guess, even though it's menacing, I don't know if it's necessarily terrifying if you come across a swirling black mass.
It sounds like something out of a Miyazaki film.
Yeah, it kind of is, isn't it?
This little spooky, what are they called? The ash, little ash monsters?
Yeah, it's kind of similar.
Kind of thing.
But this case, he claims that what he did is he wanted to turn the light to get a better look. So he brushed past this thing. And as he was brushing past it, trying not to touch it and reaching his hand over, he did touch it. And he said the moment that he did, these two prongs shot out of this thing straight for his throat. And he said the prongs felt like these two solid blunt sticks. And whatever they had in mind couldn't be completed, fortunately, because as soon as the light was flicked on, the cloud just vanished. It just started dissipating before. It was almost like the light was capable of destroying this thing, but didn't completely go away. It didn't get rid of it. Because he said for another couple of nights, when he opened the barn one night, this thing just came floating out and his dogs just started chasing after it. And it all accumulated with the dogs barking and yapping at this thing. It was almost like it lost interest after it killed all the pigs, and it just floated off into the night sky. He never saw it again. But 10 years later, we find another report of a person interacting with a cloud-like entity, and this is the story of Mary Winters. Mary Winters moved to Miami in 1963 after having a terrible divorce. She'd just moved into this new home that she'd purchased, but like all, you know, these good stories of haunted homes, it started badly because she had a bad feeling about it as soon as she moved in. She said she would find furniture tipped over, lights would turn on and off by themselves, and the cats apparently would be terrified of this unseen entity. All the hallmarks of a poltergeist haunting, apart from the fact that there didn't seem to be any poltergeist. But slowly the situation became more surreal. When about half a year later, she was preparing for bed one evening. It was around 11:30. And as she was sitting taking her shoes off, she said the door was slightly ajar and the light was coming in from the hallway. She said suddenly a cloud of smoke seeped into the room and slowly rose to the ceiling. It was like this large, turbulent black cloud. Not knowing what to do, and she completely panicked, she jumped into bed and pulled the covers over her head, which she realized that that's kind of foolish. That's a very childish thing to do. So she pulled the covers back. But when she did, she said the large undulating black mass was above the bed and was slowly descending directly down on top of her. Now, as she did this and she started to scream, she decided that she wanted to jump out of bed and run. Two weird appendages burst from the sides of this cloud and wrapped around her throat. She said they felt like ice and she was paralyzed and could hardly breathe. Now, as she's fighting with this cloud, this smoke that's over her bed, she managed to throw herself off the bed, but the thing's hands, still wrapped around her neck, went with it and pulled the cloud towards her. Now, as she's still struggling for life and everything's being pulled out of her, she said that she could suddenly hear this low, soft, but menacing voice make this sound. It was a And she said it transmitted this thought with that sound directly into her head, that once it was finished with her, her 8-year-old son in the other room would be next.
Ugh.
Now, this gave her the determination that she had to fight back against whatever this thing was. And as she's struggling, she manages to reach up to the lamp and flick the lamp on. The moment she flicked the lamp on, just like the last case, it was almost like the light striking this thing was enough to disrupt its cellular structure or its smoke structure, whatever the hell it is. And the thing just started to dissipate and disappear into nothing. Now, immediately she didn't call the police because how's she going to describe that she's been attacked by a cloud? She calls a friend who comes over straight away. And when the friend comes over, the friend says that in the darkness, they can see that in the bedroom, about an hour later, that cloud thing had reappeared, had rematerialized. She ended up sleeping for the next couple of nights with the light on and the thing never reappeared. But she left soon afterwards with her son, moved out, and the place actually had to be torn down. So very, very strange incidents. And up until now, though, I mean, there hasn't been, while there is fear and it's grabbing people by the throat, there hasn't been any type of direct physical damage. I mean, these people recover. Yeah, they've been strangled, but there's no long-term physical damage. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'm going to describe a couple of cases where there is significant physical damage caused by some of these smoke-like entities. You're listening to Mysterious Universe. Don't go away. The scariest stories are true. Amazon Prime exclusive Lore is a chilling 6-episode anthology series from an executive producer of The Walking Dead and an executive producer from The X-Files. Based on the podcast phenomenon with over 70 million downloads, creator and narrator Aaron Mankey explores the most terrifying tales throughout history. Each uniquely creepy episode takes a myth that's rooted in historical folklore and twists it, exposing timeless terrors that still haunt us today. Real life can scare you to death. Watch exclusively on Amazon Prime Video. Law, now on Amazon Video. You're back listening to Mysterious Universe, and we are covering some strange entities that are not like normal entities that you would expect to encounter. They're not humanoids. They're some type of smoke-type entities.
Well, that one before the break was terrifying, because before that communication of it saying your son is next, you could argue that maybe it's some kind of undiscovered gaseous entity.
Yeah, exactly.
But the fact that there's that communication is terrifying, because it suggests some kind of really intelligence, sentience, of course, but intelligence as well.
And not even just the intelligence. It means that they understand us. It means it actually knows what it's doing.
And that's where it crosses over with the old hag syndrome and people seeing shadow people.
Yes.
In hypnagogic states. And especially it brings back to memory, Louis Proud's description of seeing a shadow person in his room.
Yep.
And his words in his book were that it was tasting his mind.
Yeah,
tasting his mind,
about that. Yeah.
Making that connection, and it really felt an intrusion, a mental intrusion from this entity.
Well, I think also, I mean, some people, when you hear these cases, are quick to dismiss them as being, you know, hypnagogic experiences or being, you know, half waking dreams or that kind of stuff. But these cases, the people are actually awake. They're just about to climb into bed. They haven't even entered into that pre-sleep state, and they're being attacked by these things. But it seems like these things do wait around in bedrooms. It seems like they do target people when we're about to enter into that state. It makes me wonder, why? Are we more vulnerable as we enter into the sleep state? And are they just being a little bit premature in their attacks? Is this later on, do these things form into the actual shadow person experience? But up until now, and before the break, I mentioned that there hadn't been any direct physical damage, but I've got a couple of cases, one very close to home, where there was direct, significant physical damage. And there was a case from James Law. This happened all the way back in Kenton, Ohio in 1853. And Law claims that one night he said, as he was sitting in bed, just about to get ready for bed, just about to fall asleep, even though he hadn't fallen asleep yet, a strange white cloud appeared in the ceiling overhead. He said the cloud floated to the north wall of the room and then flowed down to the floor as if it was dropping down. He said as he was watching this thing, with an inexplicable burst of speed, this thing advanced towards him like a snake striking its prey. It struck him in the arm just before the shoulder, and he said it went through him like lightning. This indescribable, terrible pain went all through his body. But when he looked and peeled back his shirt, he actually had what is consistent with an electrical burn all over his skin.
Oh.
And even when he said it felt like lightning, the fact that he had this strange electrical sort of arcing across his skin was suggesting that this entity had used some type of electrical force to attack him. But there's nowhere in the world that you're safe from these things, apparently, because this incident happened in Sydney, Australia, back in 1947. And the reason why it's just so compelling is because Theo actually looked through archive records, which I went and confirmed, and this actually appeared in the New South Wales Supreme Court.
What?
So there was a man by the name of Nick Danilatos. And Nick Danilatos was travelling on a train between Redfern Station and Newtown Stations. Now, he was sitting in the train with the cabin window just slightly ajar when another train passed by. Now, when this other train passed by, it was almost like the other train was carrying something and something jumped off it. But he couldn't quite tell. He could just see this strange steam-like mass, this white steamy mass appear at the window. Now, at first, he just thought that it literally was steam until it dawned on him that, wait a minute, there was a train travelling, we're travelling. Steam just doesn't sit at the window, seemingly wanting to come in. He said, as he thought that, whatever this thing was, it actually started moving through the crack, sublimating itself through the crack in the window. As it did so, the next thing he knows, he realizes that he's lying over the back of the seat and he's got his terrible pain in his arm. He looks up and he's broken his arm. He's severely broken his arm. Now, his wife, who was watching the whole thing, says that she caught a glimpse. She heard this hissing sound as this thing came through the window. Then it struck her husband, went flying for her husband and broke his arm and then just disappeared. Now, this actually ended up in the Supreme Court, and he was awarded £800 in damages.
What? Who did he sue?
Well, he sued the New South Wales government.
For allowing demons onto their
trains.
Well,
who knows what it was, but the strange thing is what makes this case so bizarre is that even in the court conceded that there may be a possibility that he was in fact, or they entertained, that the cloud might have been a supernatural being, affording him £800 in compensation.
Why is the railway responsible for that, though?
I have no idea. But the strange thing is that when the investigations were conducted, he definitely had, obviously, he had a broken arm, but there was no broken window, there were no projectiles inside, and there was no damage to anywhere else in the cabin, apart from his broken arm. So it wasn't like something had been thrown up from another train passing or whatever else. Whatever it was some type of cloud substance that had come through that window and had inflicted this terrible injury upon this man.
I don't understand all that. I just don't understand why the rail network has to pay for it. Why is it their fault?
I don't know.
What kind of judge is ruling this case?
I don't know. It's the 1940s. I mean, take it up with your local member of parliament.
I will. I'm going to write an angry letter.
I've got an angry letter about a case that happened back in, 1947.
Forget re-releasing the JFK files. This is the case we need to crack.
That £800, I mean, that's a lot of money these days. Look, before I go, though, I as I said, I wanted to go through these different states of matter. And, you know, we haven't even got
to plasma yet.
We've entertained gas, but now I want to go to liquids.
Oh, yes.
Yes, we'll go to liquids.
It's my favourite of all the states of matter.
A couple of gels. So, I mean, gels could be classified as liquids.
How is gels not a state?
Well,
come on.
I didn't get all the way to solid, so I'm going to say that we'll go with gel for my solid. So after all of that stuff, I was, again, just happened to be on Mysterious Universe while we do run it, and Nick published another article this week about people having encounters with extraterrestrial fluids and extraterrestrial liquids. And it's not as filthy after that look on your face. I realize what I said.
That's
after
a very
I said it.
Clever way to catch our regular golden shower segment.
You know
just
what?
Disguise it as an alien story.
I tried so hard to fit in extraterrestrial golden showers into the headlines, but I could only come up with extraterrestrial golden baths. And it's not even extraterrestrial.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time it's appeared on the show.
That is true. But see, what happened was, because Nick is an investigator and he does all this reporting, he has plenty of people that contact him from all around the world about their different cases. And this woman contacted him. And she claims that after reading his book that was published in 2015, The Men in Black, she said that she wanted to get in contact with him because she had been harassed by a Men in Black type creature after being abducted multiple times in the 1980s. Now, she says, though, that she was always harassed by the same Men in Black. And Nick says this is really important because for the most cases, people that are even repeat abductees are not harassed by the same Men in Black every single time.
Oh, right.
It's quite rare, but for this woman to be experiencing the same thing over and over and over, it's really, really odd. But before I get into her case, I just want to describe a MyLab that Nick points out at the start of his article, because it kind of sets the scene for this strange liquid that is used in abductions, whether they're human or extraterrestrial, it doesn't matter. Many people that are abducted and are taken aboard UFOs or into underground subterranean facilities, claim that they're submerged into some type of mysterious liquid or gel. And that's not just, you know, submerged up to your neck. They're completely submerged. And yet the abductees report that the liquid doesn't prevent them from breathing normally. Mm. So one of the earliest MyLab experiences that Nick points us out is from some research by a researcher by the name of Helmut Lamarr. Now, Helmut Lamarr reports this experience of a MyLab abductee, or a military abduction abductee, Lisa, who suffered a very traumatic experience. Lisa claims that she was taken to some subterranean facility. She doesn't know where. But this was definitely a human abduction. It was set up to look like an alien abduction, but there were humans involved. She says when she was taken inside this facility, she was terrified to see naked human beings floating in glass tubes in some type of strange liquid. She said she herself was then immersed, completely immersed, in some type of golden yellow bubbling fluid. And she panicked and she tried to hold her breath for as long as possible, but she was completely submerged and there was nothing that she could do. And she finally breathed the liquid in. But she found that she actually could breathe. The liquid was allowing somehow for her blood to be oxygenated. And these human beings were all just standing around watching and examining and writing things down. So why would they? I mean, it got me thinking today, is that why would my labs be doing that? And the only thing I could think of is that because of the reports that Nick has, and I'll mention those just in a moment, it seems like the extraterrestrials have been doing this for a long time anyway, and maybe this is some type of reverse technology that we're copying.
What makes you think it's humans doing this to her?
Because she claims they're humans. She said they're human beings. They're humans that are floating in the tube. They're humans that are shoving into the tube. There are humans that are, you know, monitoring and doing these strange experiments around her. She says, this is not extraterrestrials. This is some type of underground military facility.
Yeah, I mean, Nick's right, though. There's been a lot of these claims over the years from so-called abductees. We covered one recently, just a few months ago. I told the story of a young girl who, she was always terrified of swimming and the parents could never figure out why. She's just absolutely terrified of the pool and specifically the light, the lights in the pool.
That's right.
Wasn't necessarily the water. Like she could go to the beach and she'd be fine, but if she was around the pool and it had an underwater light in it, she would flip out. And the memories that later surfaced were almost exactly the same as what you're describing. Mm. She was taken to a pool, but she just said it was by the usual alien grays and forced into, with other children, forced into this pool of strange liquid. And essentially being encouraged to, actually, no, they said a thing came down from the ceiling and forced them into the liquid.
That's right.
Where eventually, of course, they have to breathe and they realize that they can breathe in whatever this substance is.
Well, I mean, it leads one to question, is this a human developed technology or is this being acquired off world? And the reason why I say that is because Nick includes these two cases. One is an abductee that said this. He said, I found myself inside a clear glass cylinder. I was totally submerged in some kind of weird, warm fluid. It was thicker than water, but thinner than oil. To my surprise, I was able to breathe this warm fluid without discomfort. I could open my eyes without a problem, and the solution was clear with this greenish-coloured tinge to it. The cylinder was softly lit with a light below. I remember while I was sitting fully submerged in this solution that my memories of my abduction that had happened only moments or perhaps hours ago slowly started coming back to me. So I find that odd. It's almost like the screen memory had worn off or he'd only come to when he was inside this fluid. But the next case is even more terrifying. An abductee said this, I woke up, I was totally naked in the middle of some type of funnel-shaped pool filled with a greenish-black gel-type liquid. The pool had to be at least 20 yards around and it was pretty deep and was made of some kind of shiny metal. But with the gel and combining it with the shiny metal, the surface was so slippery that any attempt to get out was completely thwarted by it. I then realized something very odd as I started to come to. I wasn't alone. There were at least 15 other humans in the gel with me, all of them screaming and panicking. So I find those particular cases to be the most disturbing. I mean, it's bad enough that you've been abducted in the first place.
This is not as fun as the Bigfoot gas gun segment.
But to find yourself in a pool of gel with 15 other screaming, writhing people.
How can you scream in gel?
Well, she wasn't submerged. I mean, she was in it, but she wasn't completely submerged in that case. But, I mean, they're very confronting reports. And you may ask, what's the point of submerging, you know, abductees? But there might be a possibility that they're performing some kind of test. And this is where we come all the way back to the abductee, Andrea, who had contacted Nick about her experiences. And she lives in Minneapolis, and she didn't reveal too many other details for the fact that Nick wants to protect her identity. But she claims that when she had gone through these abduction experiences, she was always taken aboard the UFO or the craft or whatever it was by these dwarfish, black-eyed entities, I'm assuming that we're talking about the greys, and would immediately be immersed into a bathtub-like apparatus that had a water in it, but it wasn't water. It was something that was slightly thicker. And she said she would always have this overwhelming sense and fear, but she'd overcome it. But she said it smelt like nail polish, like it was like acetone or something. Now, on the first occasion, as I said, she was terrified, but as the moment that she could breathe this liquid, a feeling of calm came over her. And during subsequent abductions, she said that the abductors seemed to be testing how long she would remain inside the liquid comfortably before freaking out. And this seemed to get longer and longer with each abduction attempt. So they're conducting some type of test. And she said, ultimately, there was this one time where she actually felt some type of force and movement in the fluid. And she thought that maybe the craft had taken off somewhere into the skies or whatever else. And she was actually feeling the G-force effects. And it really got me thinking that if you were to travel at the speed of light this is something which is covered in Star Trek, which is actually a pretty good deal. Yes, I know that it's fiction and whatever else, but it makes a really valid point. If you're going to be inside a starship and you suddenly accelerate to the speed of light or beyond the speed of light, you're going to be completely turned into guts. You're going to be torn apart.
Yeah, and no amount of gel is going
to
stop that.
No, well, but of course, in Star Trek, they've got the concept of inertial dampness to stop that effect.
Right.
Like, for example, I think there was this thing that was quoted from a physics point that if you actually were in a starship and you were trying to slow it down, it would take 15 years or something to safely slow it down, even from half light speed. But there's a possibility that maybe, and this is just tossing an idea out there, maybe the gel is for some type of testing of maybe a physical form of an inertial dampener for when they're taking subjects back to wherever they're taking them. Maybe they want to keep live subjects when they abduct people off the Earth, when they do their missing 411 cases and people just disappear. Maybe they need to keep them in some type of storage. I mean, even with their advanced superior technology, it seems like the extraterrestrials and the humans that are conducting these my labs still need human test subjects, which is what makes, I think, this phenomenon still so absolutely terrifying. Because even now, like when you think about our modern science and when you talk about atomic testing, for example, we don't need to explode atomic bombs anymore because we have computer models that can do it for us. You would think that extraterrestrials would no longer require to abduct human beings because they would have advanced enough technology to be able to mimic that.
Maybe they're training them for something.
Yeah, that's a possibility.
That, in the cases that I covered recently on the Plus shows, that was the feeling you got from the people that were claiming this was happening to them. Their memories indicated that it was some kind of test that they had to pass. And if you remember that very, the very last test of that abductee, I can't remember her name now, but the one who was terrified of the swimming pool with the light in it, she claims she was taken somewhere and she was emerged into a pool. And as she walked forward into the pool, she was encouraged by two extraterrestrials to proceed.
Yeah, that's right. They're almost excited for her.
Yeah. And when she looked down, there was some kind of weird party. There was like a weird ET party below, and she felt like it was a test. It was the final test. Like, she had to get down to this separate room below, and to do that, she had to really just submerge herself completely, breathe in this fluid, and make her way down there, which she did actually succeed in doing. And it was like I said, it was like she had passed some kind of exam that they had been training her for.
Yeah.
So why would they be training humans? What would be the end game of training humans for something?
Yeah, I mean, I honestly don't know. And then even in Andrea's case, the fact is that even though she's going through this each and every time, she's harassed by a sinister man in black after each experience. And it always seems to be the same guy. So I don't know what to make of those sorts of things, but I don't think it makes it any less terrifying. But before I go, before I finish up
this
segment,
what about solids?
I'm not going to go to solids. I mean, we got to gel. It was a long day. That's where we got.
But plasma.
I will link to all of that in the show notes so you can check it out for yourself. But I will give you a true life alleged lost smoke monster, because I did promise you that. Now, the reason why I think these particular cases are so compelling is because these things were reported before Lost came out. So
Right. Now,
seriously, if you Google smoke monster, you just get a whole heap of subreddits and people are like, I was attacked by the smoke monster from Lost. Like, no, you weren't. I don't believe you. But apparently...
Well, you don't think there was smoke monsters before Lost? You think Lost invented smoke monsters?
No. I just think that people... Because I don't think people are very imaginative for the most part, especially when it comes to subreddits about paranormal phenomena. And I think that if you're going to start claiming, I was attacked by a smoke monster, it's like, come on, you can come up with something better than that.
You just did all these reports of people that were attacked by smoke monsters.
But what I'm saying is the cases that occurred before things pop up in pop culture, I think have more credence behind them. And this comes from the late 1800s, where tourists and freighters were claiming to be attacked by a lost-style large smoke monster in the Pike National Forest in the Colorado National Park, or just in Colorado. So campers were reporting that, much like the other stories I've told today, that they would be stalked by this smoke-like monster while they were camping, and they would have the campfire running, and this thing wouldn't come close until the campfire died down. But when the campfire died down or the light dissipated, this smoke-like monster would come over and envelop them and make them be overcome with this musty, nauseating smell. It would gas them and then take off back into the forest. So it wouldn't cause any direct physical damage, but it was chasing people, stalking people in the darkness, gassing them, and then just disappearing. Very much like a snake. It would snake its way through the forest and just disappear.
What's the smell described as?
It was this musty smell. They said it was nauseating
okay. And
musty. And once this thing left there, it was strange because it only happened for a period of 10 to 15 years, and then the phenomenon and the reports all died off. So again, going in patterns, going in waves. So who knows? But if you go out camping in the, what's it called? The Pike National Forest in Colorado, be careful. There might be a lost smoke monster out there.
As soon as you smell something off, it's either Bigfoot, murderous smoke monster, a gaseous alien abduction.
Yeah, you're screwed.
No, I can't win out there. Just got to stay inside all the time. Just look at computers all day. Well, that's what we do.
Yeah, but which is not healthy anyway. Though. That's really bad.
That's why we're going to live to 58.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I like stories like this, though, because, I mean, there is so much phenomena out there. But most of the time, like, you think of humanoids, you think of aliens, you think of, you know, shadow person encounters. But then it's really good to expand your perspective on what there could be out there. And for there to be reports of clouds that break people's arms, I don't know. There's a lot more out there than we could ever even imagine.
I don't know how you run that court case. That is just ridiculous. We're ridiculous. What's the law coming to?
I will link to the actual news report in the show. It's from the Australian Archives. It's actually in there. I hunted it down, but I'll also link to the article in the Fortean Times and, of course, all of the articles that were on our site published by Nick.
Well, I should set the scene for what's coming up in our Plus extension.
Yes, please
We've still got a few minutes left in our free show. I might tell the story of the two monks involved in this book, Reincarnation, the Boy Lama from Vicky McKenzie. And these two lamas are really instrumental. They were instrumental in bringing Tibetan Buddhism to the West. And that might seem like a simple thing of just, okay, well, let's go over to America and start teaching people. But you've got to understand that there was this idea in Tibet that the Western mind wasn't capable, or the Westerner was somehow barbaric compared to the Tibetans. They really saw them in a lower light and had all these notions about whether they would ever be able to understand what they practiced. So the story from Vicky is really interesting, the author of this book, because she describes how back in October of 1976, the Tibetan Buddhism or meditation was the last thing on her mind. She wasn't really interested in it. She wasn't thinking about it. And she was working at the frantic office at the time of the Daily Mail. She was doing tabloid journalism. And she got a call one day from Leslie Kenton, who was the health and beauty writer. And she wanted to speak to the editor, but they just had a quick conversation. And Vicky asked Leslie what she was up to, and she said, "Oh, I'm about to go to Nepal to meditate with lamas." And Vicky goes, "Oh, that's wonderful. What a superb thing to do." And this woman just goes, "Well, why don't you come with me?" And she found herself replying, "Yes, I'll do that," not really understanding why. It just kind of came out, and it seemed preposterous as she ran it through her head. She, again, didn't know anything about Buddhism. She'd never been to Nepal, never been to India. She had no idea about meditation, nothing. But she found herself agreeing to this crazy trip. And when she hung up the phone, she had this strange feeling that what she was about to do was, for some reason, absolutely right. And she felt this strange happiness, and she didn't understand why.
It's almost like a case of fate.
Yeah, it's certainly, you get the sense of that from her. So she describes this frenzy of arranging air tickets, getting visas, you know, getting the vaccinations.
Yeah, it would have been hard to get into India and Nepal back then, right?
I have no idea. I mean,
even now it's still hard. I mean, if you want to go to India, you've got to get a visa these days.
Well, you definitely need thermal underwear for when they were going, because it was the middle of November, December, so right. It would have been freezing. And when she arrived, they went to the Kopan Monastery in Nepal. All her fears were kind of dispelled, or her anxiety disappeared, because she describes this magnificent destination. It's overlooking the Kathmandu Valley, just beautiful bamboo everywhere. You've got frangipani trees and just this wonderful place, with the backdrop being the Himalayan ranges.
Oh, wow.
You can just imagine how stunning it would be.
Yeah, spectacular.
And this community there is made up of a really small group of Tibetan lamas. There's a bunch of the young boys in robes, and just a handful of Westerners too, who have actually been ordained as monks and nuns, and they're all relaxed and smiling. And she feels kind of, this is going to be great. This is going to be amazing. And then she's taken to her quarters, and the schedule is explained. So the quarters, and this is a month-long retreat. And think about that. Someone who's never meditated for a second in their life.
It would be hell.
Goes to Nepal to meditate for a month, for 30 days. Yep. And the quarters is basically this tiny concrete room with just straw flooring. And she's going to spend 30 days with seven other women in this room. There's the windows are just empty with bars on them. So the Himalayan cold is coming in at night.
Oh, God.
There's no bathroom. There's no sink. There's no hot water. The toilet is just a hole in the ground. To actually get water, you've got to go all the way down to the bottom of the mountain, fill up your own buckets and carry it back to the top. And then she's like, immediately she's like, what the hell have I gotten myself into? I've made a huge mistake.
Yeah, that wasn't in the brochure.
But then she gets told the schedule by one of the nuns that's been there for a while. And the schedule is up at 4:30 a.m. Into the meditation tent by 5. You get a tiny soybean coffee at 6 a.m., then back to the tent for more meditation at 6:30. You get a breakfast of porridge at 8. You get some teachings at 9. More meditation at 11:30 a.m., a tiny vegetarian lunch at 12:30. You have discussion groups at 2, more teachings at 3:30 p.m., tea at 5:30, meditation at 6, tiny hot chocolate at 7:30, meditation at 8, and bed by 9 p.m.
God, how exhausting.
Every single day for 30 days in the freezing cold Himalayas.
But is that actually designed to shock people? Is it designed to shock Westerners into a new way of thinking or?
No. She added it up and she figured out that's about 12 hours of sitting in meditation a day.
Oh, God.
And she realizes, well, she actually explained that the reason they do this isn't to punish you. It's they're trying to create the most conducive environment to clear the mind.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It's like, it's, I shouldn't say shocking, but yeah, they're doing something to change the state of your mind.
Exactly. That's designed for a purpose. And there's all these other rules, like there's obviously no alcohol, no tobacco, no drugs, no sex, no...
Great. No fun at all.
Are you happy with everything else but no sex?
No, everything. I mean, no tobacco, no alcohol, no sex, and no music. What are you going to do?
You can't send mail. There's no radio. There's no newspapers. No TV, obviously. No telephone. And you can't leave. So you're basically... It's not like you can get a couple of days in and go, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. It's like, too bad.
I've been trying to escape. I just got this image of being chased by llamas.
Yeah, with pitchforks. Yeah. I can see you running naked from a Tibetan llama street. I can definitely see that. So she felt really fortunate, though, to be living this story. As a journalist, she could appreciate, especially with the kind of people that were there, she thought, well, there must be so many stories here. And she really threw herself into it. But as she spent time there, she started to hear rumors about the llamas themselves. Rumors that they were clairvoyant. Rumors that they had psychic powers. That they didn't sleep or eat. Apparently some of them could fly and others could materialize and dematerialize their bodies at will.
And then gas people in their bedrooms.
And then gas, yeah. They'll just go down to Five Guys, pick up a burger.
Oh, that's... And I then knew it. No, come on.
Rematerialized back in Nepal.
Wow.
The course they studied was called Lam Rim, which was actually designed by a 13th century saint named Tsongkhapa. And basically it's a sequence, stages for a spiritual aspirant to follow on their journey to full liberation and realization of the ultimate. It's just like a course for enlightenment.
Isn't that death?
Not necessarily.
Right, okay.
I guess that's part of it, but it's not like that's the finish line.
Right.
That's just a part of it. It was presented to us, she says, in long discourses by Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Now, she describes Lama Zopa, who was a lama who had... It was very traditional, and he would lecture each day in this really kind of hard-to-understand English, and it took a long time to understand what he was saying. And she said she was intellectually stimulated by it. At first, it gave her answers that she felt she had been looking for, the descriptions of mind and emptiness and wisdom and reincarnation and karma. She found it intellectually stimulating, and the teachings on compassion, she really resonated with her. But the strict teachings from this Lama Zopa, she felt like the dogma and the religious side was totally incompatible to the Western mind.
Right.
But Western Mind wasn't going to buy into these multi-armed, multi-headed deities and all the rules and the 17 levels of hell. And like, it just was never going to be bought. And she felt that this was a real shame because her understanding was that there was this really powerful practice amongst that.
You mean from a, like a...
more like a secular kind of train the mind.
Right.
That's how she was viewing it.
Yeah.
And she thought, well, no one in the West is going to get that because of all this other stuff around it.
Yeah.
It's just not, it's not palatable.
Yeah.
And then she met Lama Yeshe. Now, she describes this guy winding his way between them and this jolly, beaming happiness coming out from this Lama. And all he would say when they met them was, thank you, thank you, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Is it the only English word he knows?
No, they said that, the other monks said that his spiritual attainment, like he had reached this level where it's like the ultimate state of gratitude. Like there's all these stories of him when he eventually went to America of getting pulled over by the police because he was a horrible driver. And he would just be like, oh, thank you, thank you. Oh, thank you, thank you. Oh, so generous, thank you.
He'd say $900 fine and here's another $700 one.
Yeah, he'd just say thank you all the time. And the impact that this Lama had on Vicky was immediate. She said, I'd never seen such warmth, such an abundance of joy, such an overwhelming humanity in anyone. Lama Yeshe, she said, dispelled in one moment any notion I had that an Eastern sage was cold and inscrutable. You know, the idea that he had gotten rid of all emotion and transcended emotion. The guy would laugh all the time. He would crack jokes. He was just constantly, he was just a jolly, fun guy to be around. And when he first met these students, all these Westerners, he's like, any problems? And someone dared to ask him this question, Vicky said. They asked him, how could Tibetan Buddhism be integrated into normal, everyday Western life? Like I explained before, like how is it going to fit? And she says he launched into the most incongruous English I'd ever heard. And he'd kind of picked up his English over the years from all the hippie Westerners. Like he'd learnt all the terms. So he's like saying totally rad, bodacious, that's radical. You know, he would pick up all these crazy hippie terms. And he kind of spoke like Yoda, where you had to, everything was back to front and you kind of had to make sense of it. So he says, meditation is not blissing out, dude. It's not some kind of trip, man. You do not think I am so special. I am doing some special kind of Eastern meditation. He says, Buddhism is inner thing. It is seeing and growing your own potential. Everyone has Buddha nature, has his or her own wisdom and compassion. Don't get hung up on all oriental form. A Buddha just means a fully awakened being. He doesn't have to have yellow skin and slanty eyes. So,
talk about all embracing, I suppose.
But for her, this is like all her despair vanishes because here's this Lama saying, bliss out, man. It's not a trip. And you don't have to be an Orient, you don't have to buy into this,
but that's
Oriental stuff.
It's funny, I mean, this is back in the 1970s, but I think that's not all people, but I think there's certainly an element of people that say, I'm a Buddhist, who are actually doing it because they think you're going to get a high out of it. There's some type of trip involved in it.
That's the thing. And he's making the point that it's, you don't have to, like when he says you don't have to buy into this Oriental form, he's communicating to her saying, you don't have to buy all the dogma.
Yeah.
And for her, she says, this Lama speaking my language. He's this modern psychological man. He's got shaved heads and robes, but he understands this and he has this irrefutable spiritual truth to him.
That's why I like Zen Buddhism, because it's not about dogma. It's about a way of living. It's about appreciating nature. I like that concept.
So she's totally taken by this guy. And
I can see why.
He has this really jovial, fun way of teaching. He's cracking jokes all the time, like teasing people, making fun. And this guy, Yeshe, and the really traditional guy, Zopa, who just lectures the really traditional way, they're like the perfect team because they, you know, one guy gives all the written stuff. And then
good cop, bad cop, Buddha stuff.
Yeah, the Yeshe guy comes along and just like cracks jokes and speaks like a hippie to them. So he continues to give them this weird Yoda-like wisdom. He came out with the most outrageous statement, she said. Here's one. He said, the Dharma is like an American bed. Everyone can fit in. You clever people, you think your supermarket enjoyment is real, but I'm telling you, you're so miserable. However, you can transform this miserable into everlasting blissful chocolate. Ha! Now you're going to say, he crazy, he Himalayan gorilla. Well, I'm saying, you just check up. You just check up.
Check up what? I'm lost now.
Yeah, I was a bit lost too. He's saying, okay, so first of all, he's saying, you clever people, you think your supermarket enjoyment is real.
No, I get that. So, you're giving up attachments.
No, but she's saying the supermarket world for the West, it's full of overabundance, all these material goods.
Desire.
Yeah, but it doesn't alleviate the mental unrest that lies beneath our civilization. That's
what
he's saying.
Have you ever done a really decent retail therapy? You know?
Yeah, it feels good for a little bit.
Yeah. That vacuous hole that is unfilled and you have to go shopping again.
When you come back to the studio and you've got 900 shirts in the back of your car. Like your shopping spree a couple of years ago. I'm feeling depressed. I'm off to buy a couple of pairs of clothes. Comes back. Boxes of shirts. I don't know. What is it with you and the shirts?
I don't know.
That's your zen.
Yeah, it is.
Trying on a fresh, crisp country road shirt.
No, it's not that. Actually, to be honest with you, it was from my aunt. Because before my aunt passed away, when I used to have fun with her, because my aunt was really stylish. She was kind of like, you know, Iris Apfel. She was always about color and style. So whenever I hung out with her, she'd take me shopping. So after she died and I was depressed and sad about it, I go and do the same thing. But of course, I get a little bit out of control and maybe max my credit card out a bit. Yeah.
Did you ever put all those 900 shirts on eBay?
Yeah, I did actually.
Oh, you did get some money back?
I've got a whole heap of the money back right now.
That's good. Well, and by saying you, at the end he says, well, I'm saying you just check up, you just check up. He's saying, if you look into this, you'll find that it's true. And you know, that was just the way he communicated. He just would talk in these really strange back to front ways.
But he gets his point across.
Yeah, it would kind of make sense. And he would often just burst into peals of laughter and he would, you know, throw things at people. And just he was a bit of a clown as well, which the Westerners really liked. So she made a real connection with him on this trip, Vicky. And she said, Lama Yeshe touched something in me and I would never quite be the same again. After the month is up, she flies back to London and she finds that once she's in familiar surroundings, she's back with old friends, she's back in the city, she had changed. She says the roar of the great metropolis that used to fill her with excitement, she found now unbearable. And the dinner parties bored her and exhausted her. The conversation she once thought was witty was now trivial and like this sad cover-up for a lost meaning. It's trying to cover up a lack of meaning. And she wanted to go to bed at 9 every night. She said, most of all, it was the faces that I saw on the street and in the tube, which so distressed me. They were marked with a slow tension and heaviness, the penalty for keeping up with the frenetic pace of Western society, she said. And she started to question her career as well. She's like, do I really want to write fake news every day? Because she's, you know, the Daily Mail was tabloid journalism.
Especially back in the 70s.
And she said, when I stopped and thought about it, like everything I wrote would warp the facts. And often, you know, I would hurt people with my articles because I would twist something around to be more sensational than it actually was. And it would cause damage. And she just started to slowly change. She tried to meditate every morning, but eventually, this effect that she'd gotten, we hear this time and time again, the effect that she'd gotten from the retreat started to fade away.
Mm.
That really started her search again for what she'd experienced in Nepal with this Tibetan guru. And when we come back after the break with our Plus extension, the story starts to evolve because eventually we hear more about this colorful, jovial, clowning guru in a way, Lama Yeshe, and some of the exploits about him. He really wanted to understand the West. He wanted to understand how Westerners think so he could try and be a better teacher for them. So he would do things like make an unannounced, just kind of slip away from the monastery in Nepal, catch a plane to Hong Kong, change into a suit and go to a nightclub.
For what purpose, though?
To try and understand how Westerners behave.
Fair enough.
when he would go to foreign countries and just watch commercials all day to try and understand the psychology of that particular country. The guy went to all these crazy lengths to try and understand the Western mind, and some of it is quite hilarious when we hear the antics he gets up to after the break in our Plus extension. But where this story ultimately goes is to a young boy born in a tiny village in Spain after the passing of this Tibetan Lama, who seems to have the same mannerisms, the same memories of this Tibetan Lama.
Oh, he's come back in the West.
This was one of the very first cases of a Tibetan Lama predicting the date of his death, predicting that he would return, and the reincarnation that's found is a Western kid, not a Tibetan.
Yeah, which is highly, highly unusual.
Really strange stuff coming up when we get into how they were able to verify the connection between this young Spanish boy and this Tibetan Lama that eventually passed away in 1987. And we're going to find out where he is today, because when this book was written, the author was following this kid up until the age of 4. He's now in his
25,
early 20s.
Right.
So we're going to find out whether he became the great teacher he was prophesied to be. Maybe we can follow him on Twitter and see what he's been posting.
Oh, God. I have see a what strange his feeling like. About where this is going.
Let's see what happens. That's coming up in our Plus extension. If you want to get access to that, head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. All the details are there. You get extensions on our shows every single Friday. You sometimes doubling the length of the show you get. We put on these huge extensions every single week. And if you sign up for Plus, you get an entirely exclusive show every single Tuesday as well. So you're getting much more than double the content we put out for our free listeners. If you're on Plus, you get so much more. And you get a higher bitrate feed, 320 kilobits per second. MP3s are available to our Plus members. You get all the ads removed from our podcast as well. The show is totally ad-free for Plus. You get a massive discount on our back catalogue store. We've got 50% off still running for Plus members. And you get all the features of our apps unlocked as well. Again, all the details are at mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. $9 a month helps support your favourite show. Yes.
And that's a wrap.
Can you agree with me, please, when I'm doing the sales
pitch? No, I'm agreeing.
No one can see you nodding there. Oh, of course. Going, yeah, it's a great deal.
It's late, okay? It's late in the studio. I didn't realize. Look, it is. I'm sorry. I save the best for Plus. I really do. I aim for Plus. I want to entertain Plus. Sign up for Mysterious Universe Plus. Check it out.
So solids and plasmas are coming up in Plus. Yeah.
We'll find something. We'll see what we can cram in there.
Again, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Check it out. If you're on the website, check out season, what are we up to? Season 18, episode 17, to find the links to everything we've spoken about today. That's a wrap. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Welcome back to your Plus extension. Great to have you with us. We're talking about the Spanish Lama baby.